Ladies and gentlemen, you are tuning into It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse, and I'm bringing you Trevor James Constable. I've had the opportunity of interviewing some of the most remarkable people in the world. A person who has formed a new energy power plant, David Slauson from Sterling Energy. Joe Longo from StarTech, who has formed a waste elimination technological company, which eliminates chemical weapons and uranium, takes it, puts it into a plasma converter, destroys it at a molecular level, renders it inert, and converts it to a usable utility. Sound out of the box? It's out of this world. But you know what? What they've been doing is very real and very needed by humankind. And so is the work of Trevor James Constable. The man you're about to be introduced to is a weather engineer. He is also the author of 12 books, 4 on aviation. He has the ability, not only the life experience of having been influenced by the work of Wilhelm Reich and Rudolf Steiner, he has the ability to literally make it rain. Not only does he literally make it rain, he has the ability to get rid of smog and to eliminate it. And he also has a lot to say about hurricanes. But let's not wait any further, because Trevor James Constable has been waiting many, many years to bring you this kind of nature of broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the mighty force that he is, Trevor James Constable. Welcome to It's Rainmaking Time, sir.
Thank you for that lavish introduction.
My pleasure.
Don't let anybody know that I wrote it.
Well, you know, you really deserve a lavish introduction, and you have something that is very needed by a great part of humanity. Not only are many of us familiar with the fact that there are droughts throughout the world and countries that are outside of the United States of America, but millions upon millions of people don't have access to drinking water, fresh drinking water. And let's talk about what a rainmaker is, because I got very excited about this term some years ago when I was looking for a metaphor that I could translate to the public that children could understand and adults could understand about the magic of bringing something about. Mm-hmm. And something that it would involve the spirit and it involves skill and it involves a love of bringing something in. And today, a rainmaker is known as somebody who makes a commitment and delivers it, mm-hmm. makes a promise and delivers it. But in this particular case, a rainmaker is understood on indigenous terms to mean a person like a medicine man or woman who prays and literally asks the spirit world to bring in the rain. Some people would say that that isn't even believable, and yet there are people like this out in the world who do this. What do you think about this?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that there are people who do that. Native peoples, the tribes in Seminole tribes in Florida have that ability. Some of the medicine men of those Seminole tribes have repeatedly produced rain down there. And the old Hawaiian kahunas are a classic case of it.
What did they do?
They made rain in Hawaii. They made it rain there. It was a part of their magical processes.
When you say part of their magical process,
mm-hmm.
what exactly does that mean?
Well, the whole of the Huna magic is an advanced system of metaphysical thinking and acting. You know, it's a complete fabric of knowledge that they used and still do use. Healing and things like that, and of course, rain engineering. They have been doing that for generations there. Max Freedom Long made that clear in his several books on Huna magic.
Is it something that's accessible to all of us from
your
experience?
Yes, it is. There are ways into Huna magic for the ordinary person if they wish to study it. You find those advertised in magazines like Fate and similar magazines to that. You see ads for Huna teacher who will take you in.
But that's not the kind of weather engineering that you do.
No, it's not.
It has something completely different.
That's right. It's related to it in as much as they use the vital force. They use the qi, as the Chinese call it, the most common name other than orgone energy developed by Wilhelm Reich.
So let's go back a little bit to the introduction of new knowledge. I think it's very critical that you establish a frame of reference for all of us, because the introduction of new knowledge would seem to be obvious. It's just knowledge that's new. But that's not the kind of new knowledge that you're introducing.
No, not at all.
Talk about that for us.
Well, new knowledge in the sense that I mean it, which is with a capital N and a capital K, is a complete effort to reach into the spiritual world for certain principles and understanding of the way that the physical world works. The physical world is not just a dead, inert pan. It is irradiated by energies that we know nothing about. And some of us are determined not to find out.
When you say irradiated by certain energies, what does that mean?
Well, for example, you're sitting here with me now, and your physical body is irradiated by something that the medical profession and men of science don't yet understand. Now, where does your energy come from? And why hasn't that question been asked in the universities?
That's a great question. Let's ask the question, where does my energy come from?
Right.
Vis-a-vis this conversation.
Well, it's gone pretty deeply in a hurry there. But basically, you asked to differentiate the difference between new knowledge and what I consider new knowledge. What I consider new knowledge is the knowledge of how your organism is impelled to go across the room and down the street and to go through all the processes of living. That's what I call new knowledge, and you know, I'm afraid our smartest people know very little about it.
How does the new knowledge manifest itself in terms of your work?
The new knowledge manifests itself in the particular devices that I have designed and developed through the years. And it does not really relate to anything of the old knowledge, and that's one of the reasons why it has had such a difficult birth, is that it's radically different. Radically different.
So right now, the introduction of new knowledge has to do with introducing a new spiritual dimension then.
Mm-hmm.
Is
yes,
that the
does.
Key
That's right.
to your
That's
definition
right.
of new knowledge?
Right.
Okay. And in this context, it's not just introducing, quote, a new thing, but a new principle, which becomes the filter for a new universe of understanding.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
All right. So in that context, your work has been highly influenced by Wilhelm Reich,
mm-hmm.
by Rudolf Steiner, and so much so that you worked for, what, a year in consultation with Wilhelm Reich's daughter, Eva?
Yes, who is a medical doctor.
Talk to me about your studies with her, your
well,
conversations
I
with
met her through Dr. Ruth B. Drown, the late Dr. Ruth B. Drown, who was another very decisive influence on me. And Dr. Eva Reich had a problem with an internal hemorrhage, which she was not able to arrest. It was a constant blood leak that was very difficult to deal with. And she was persuaded to get in touch with Ruth Drown, who at that time was operating a laboratory in Hollywood. And Ruth Drown, with her technology, was able to just arrest that immediately from Los Angeles. And Eva was in back in Maine.
When you say arrest that immediately, meaning what?
Meaning she stopped the bleeding from out here without any intervening...
with instruments?
With instruments,
was
right.
Was it through a kind of prayer and meditation? Was
no,
it
no,
through
nothing
a technical,
like that. No,
anything
no.
technical?
Technical, absolutely. It was an instrument that was used for it called a hemorrhage control unit.
Talk to me about that.
Well,
for a moment. I know that's not the purpose of our but you're in something and people will want to know, what is that?
That is a device that was developed by her from her technology that grounded the parathyroid glands and stopped bleeding by that means. That was the way it worked.
What was the technology?
The technology was a simple tuner.
Like a radio tuner?
Like a radio tuner, really. Very similar to a radio tuner, but much simpler. Much simpler than a radio tuner. In fact, the simplest transistor radio is 1,000 times more complicated than one of Ruth Drown's instruments. But that's how I came into contact with Eva Reich, was getting her hemorrhage stopped. And then, you know, she talked to Ruth Drown about me, and I got in touch with her, and she you know, guided me through her father's work in such a way that I didn't lose track of what he had discovered. In other words, Wilhelm Reich wrote quite a number of books, and your ability to extract from those books the wisdom and the suffering, in a sense, that was put into them depends on getting them in a certain sequence, and you need to begin with the foundational book of Wilhelm Reich, which
that?
Is The Function of the Orgasm, in which he, it's a two-volume book, quite massive in its physical constitution, and from that you were you know, able to proceed the rest of the way. If you got into one of Reich's books that was further down the line, you would not know really how it was that he got onto the things that he later embraced and developed.
You'd be off sequence and you'd be out of context.
Exactly, right out of context.
So that lends itself to tremendous distortion capability by the public.
Exactly, and that's what's happened with Reich's work, is that it's still, you know, distorted in a really complete way by the Orthodox people. They think that Wilhelm Reich was crazy. That's the psychiatric version of him. But he was anything but.
What was his ultimate discovery that lended itself so critical to the weather engineering techniques that you
Well, he understood. He got to understand what the function of the orgasm was for the very first time in the history of man.
That there was a function to this?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yes. That the orgasm had a function other than throwing out the sexual substances. Everybody knows that.
Can you tell us, what did Wilhelm Reich say was the function of the orgasm?
Function of the orgasm is to regulate the energy level of the entire body. Now, just a little while ago, we got to talking about the mystery that the animating energy is to our most profound people on Earth. I mean, they just don't know. If you say, then why don't you have a project at UCLA to investigate where the energy comes from that we use? Because, you know, when we die, we don't have energy anymore. Where is it? Where does it come from? They can't answer you. They have no answer to it at all. Wilhelm Reich developed the knowledge of the energy itself, its characteristics, its accessibility to therapy and things like that. And, you know, he died in jail. And his books and papers were burned by the government.
Because I haven't read his work,
mm-hmm.
and many of us probably haven't,
mm-hmm.
who might be listening to this, is he advocating that we should be having more orgasms, or was he pointing a direction in which that's how you isolate and understand what's animating us?
That's right. That's right.
Did I get that
correctly?
That
is correct. That's right. And the orgasm has as its function, not the mere hurling out of the sexual substances, but the regulation of the energy level of the entire body. And this stabilizes it and facilitates the motions of the energy in the body. And this is the reason why so many of our basic individual ailments that we have in psychiatry, for example, they're all based on corrupted orgasmic cycles. They're just people don't have orgasms in the right way.
That sounds, not to be disrespectful, but that could sound, for some people listening, very simplistic, you know what I'm saying. And sometimes very complex things are.
That's right.
So I understand that part. But when you say people don't know how to have orgasms in the right way, did Reich talk about that?
Oh, yes, comprehensively. That's all in Function of the Orgasm and the other books he wrote. And he was considered to be one of the most brilliant of Freud's successors. He was first clinical assistant to Freud in Vienna right after the First World War, when he was qualified at the University of Vienna. They all thought that he was a brilliant man. He used to make the whole room would fall silent when he walked in, that sort of thing. He was recognized as a brilliant individual. But then after he got into the meat of the orgasm, they said he was crazy, you see, because he was, you know, right close to the truth of human functioning.
And sometimes even when somebody, a pioneer of any kind, in any way is introducing something that is correct, that is true, that's factual. How they're perceived is based on the sign of the times, too, and how advanced the consciousness is that occupies the society collectively.
Right.
So you can have, as many predecessors have come and gone and died with their work, you know, you can have somebody who is introducing a frame of reference that the civilization at the time is either not ready for or not open to, and it was just, they got it, and they discovered it, and they communicated it, and they had to go to the grave with it.
That's right. That's right. That's what Wilhelm Reich did.
I guess my question, and then I want to go on, but about, because this is a key part of the Oregon energy, is a key part of your weather engineering access. Does one have to have orgasm or orgasms to access Oregon energy?
No, not at all. No, no more than you have to do have to have orgasms to access electricity. You access it through geometry. It works for everybody, but they just, you know, they don't accept it.
So when one is having orgasm, one is accessing a cosmic energy this sort that's already in place.
That's right.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to understand.
That's right.
Okay, very good. And the work of Rudolf Steiner, I really feel like as we proceed into introducing to the public how you literally make rain, how this is scientifically set up, we just lend some respect to Dr. Steiner.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about the most critical aspects of his work that have moved you and empowered you to deliver rain.
Yeah, well, Dr. Steiner was, first of all, a PhD from the University of Rostock and was fully formally educated in heat, light, and sound and all the conventional physical things, so that he understood fully the status of physics in his own time. And he was also a natural clairvoyant, a man with a natural ability to see beyond the physical and with the ability to translate that into doctrines and teachings that people who were studious could master and utilize. He gave over 10,000 lectures in Europe in his own lifetime and was considered to be one of the brightest men that had ever lived at that time. He laid out in his lectures the relationship between the physical body and the etheric body, which is something you can't see, the ether body, which is inside the physical body and which animates it. That's the source of the animation of the human body, is the etheric body. That conveys the vitality to the physical structure. And Steiner elaborated all this in just thousands of lectures to all manner of people, ranging from university professors all the way down to the workmen who were working on the building that he had in Switzerland, in Dornach. So he dealt with all these things in comprehensive fashion and in great detail. And I don't think there's an individual living that can pick up a Steiner book and not be astonished at what he finds in it, no matter what aspect of Steiner's work he picks on, because he was truly a universal genius. And in my case, I got onto a book whose content he approved before his death in 1925. And this was a book called The Etheric Formative Forces in the Cosmos, Earth, and Man, and it was written by Dr. Voxmuth. He was a lawyer who was Steiner's secretary for the last 20 years of Steiner's life. And Dr. Voxmuth laid out for us the complete plan of the way the ethers work in the life of the Earth, with sketches and drawings and everything else of the way they functioned. This made it possible for me to come along and get Dr. Voxmuth's book and to prove out that these flows of etheric force did exist in the life of the Earth, to tap into them and to cause them to accumulate so that they would draw water to themselves and it would rain. That is really, in a nutshell and on a thumbnail, how Steiner influenced me.
That's a big load.
Mm-hmm,
that's a very, very big load. You pushed a very big button here. So let me reiterate what I think I just heard and what the public is probably trying to chew on right now. See, you people thought gum was a problem. We just stuck a big wad in your mouth. I don't know why I should say we. I shouldn't take this on. But basically, what Steiner said, or what was discovered, was that there is an etheric body inside the body,
right,
that animates it.
Right.
And that there is an etheric body which animates the earth.
Yes.
Are they distinct but
yes.
connected?
Yeah, they're connected, but they are distinct.
They're okay, right. Just wanted to make sure.
That's right.
And so in the context of what you just said about Wilhelm Reich, where does Wilhelm Reich's discovery with organ energy connect with these two pieces?
Well, in the first place, let me emphasize that Dr. Reich never read Dr. Steiner. That is in his writings, that he never read Dr. Steiner, ever. But he just said that the anthroposophists, the people who followed Steiner, were the most human people that he had come across. But he had never read Steiner. So there is no connection, actually, direct connection between Steiner and Reich, not
okay.
at all, except
Got that.
Other than the fact that they're both Austrians.
Okay.
But that...
Something must have been really happening in Austria for all this to come out of there.
That's quite a place, Austria.
Have you been?
Yeah. Yes, it's... I wish I could go again.
Well, maybe you will. maybe I'll require you deliver a rainfall there.
Right. But that is how the two of them, they were more or less contemporaries. They never met. And they were both Austrians at the same time. So it's very strange. But those are the things that are guided from the spiritual world. In other words, it was not required that Dr. Steiner meet Dr. Reich and vice versa, that they did not meet. There was a reason for that, I'm sure.
Is it so that possibly there wasn't a competition or any type
no,
of...
No, I don't think it had anything to do with that, that they wanted two separate knowledge streams to come into
and coexist.
That's right.
Gotcha.
And I came along and put the two of them together.
All right, so you're a born synthesizer, I take it.
Yeah, that's right.
What motivated you to come into weather engineering?
Well,
how did you even get into this?
I felt that at the time that Dr. Reich had been on the earth, I didn't really understand anything about his work. I was then connected with Dr. Ruth B. Drown in Los Angeles here. And I had heard about Dr. Reich, but I had not really gone into him at all. But I became very familiar with Robert A. McCullough, who
his
was
assistant.
A,
right?
Yeah, he was an assistant to Reich for 2.5 years in Maine and also down in Tucson during the weather experiments down there in the early 50s. And Bob made me aware of the close correlation that there was between Steiner and Reich. And, of course, I did the same thing for him. I plowed him into Steiner, where he stayed for the rest of his life. And that was how, I got onto this, that what was in Voxmuth's book about the ethers in the life of the earth dovetailed with what was in Reich. And I came to the conclusion that this man had performed a monumental service by finding out, first of all, how the life force functioned in human life and how to get a hold of it, namely with a cloud buster. That was how it happened.
Interesting.
And then, of course, it was all elaboration from there on.
Elaboration and a lot of work.
That's right.
And a lot of work.
Yeah, thousands of experiments.
Let's talk one more second about the ether. I don't want to leave the ether alone because many times in the world, people have made jokes about the ether.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually referred to as a kind of joking thing, like somebody could say to somebody, oh, she's in the ethers.
Yeah.
Or that project's in the ethers. In other words, it's in a dwelling that doesn't exist. It's in the unmanifest state.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, this is a concrete but invisible
correct
membrane or substance of
That's
something.
Right. That's right.
And it's so specific. Talk about the function of the ether with regard to weather engineering, so then we can talk about the weather engineering.
Well, the relationship between the vital force and the physical world is brought about in terms of the weather by putting a metal pipe into water and waving the opposite end in the atmosphere so that you can entrain.
What does that word mean, entrain?
Entrain mean you
entrap
would...
Entrap?
Yes.
Contain?
Entrain it. I don't know how to explain it, really. It's just a word that I use quite commonly. Entrain, you would... In other words, the energy is moving more or less randomly, and when you put that pipe in there into the atmosphere, you entrain the energy. The energy goes down the pipe.
You direct it.
That's right.
Okay.
You direct it.
All right.
And you direct it. And you go from there to testing out Dr. Rocksmuth's statements about how the ether flows. It flows from north to south in the winter time in the northern hemisphere, and from south to north in the northern hemisphere in the summertime. It reverses in between the seasons. And most of the central riddles of meteorology are contained in that reversal. This is why climate changes and so forth.
Wait a minute.
Very difficult.
This is why climate changes happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, when the ether starts moving, we'll say in the springtime, from south to north, this is when you start to get the weather coming up from the south into the southern states. This is when you get the hurricanes in the eastern Atlantic. So that's where they come, when the etheric flow from the south superimposes with the flow from the east. They superimpose.
So then, given this knowledge, are hurricanes preventable? I know that's a tough question.
Yes, it is. I wouldn't say that they were preventable with existing knowledge. Let me say that.
With the capital N, capital K, new knowledge, sir.
Yeah, right.
Are hurricanes preventable?
Yes,
given your frame
so.
Of reference
right.
and experience?
You must remember that people who are into this have absolutely no resources, and the government and the necessary corporate people and so forth don't want anything to do with this. There's just no funding at all available to do this kind of work.
Describe what this kind of work is.
This kind of work would be, say, to take a fast ship, say a destroyer or a cruiser, out into the eastern Atlantic and pick off the hurricanes as they formed, because you can do that. And I've done that myself, in the Pacific. But that's the way you protect Florida, is to deactivate the hurricanes before they move across the Atlantic.
So part of your weather engineering work has to do with prevention.
Yeah.
Another part has to do with the formation of rainfall in areas that are needing it.
Yeah.
And I understand that a sideline, or while you were busy forming weather or creating rain, that you noticed that you could clear smog. Can you talk about that? Because there are so many parts of the world right now that are in terrible, almost unbreathable conditions. Just in the United States alone, the respiratory industry is skyrocketing. There's so much respiratory disease.
Yeah.
Talk about the...
Well, I think they'd rather have the disease than have it eliminated by methods like mine, because my methods work, and that eliminates, a big business that's being built up.
Let's talk about the actual clearing of the smog. Mm-hmm. I think people would definitely want to hear that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
how does it work?
We worked 3 years on that here in Los Angeles in 1987, 88, 89, and 90. And we brought smog down in 1990 in a full dress operation, brought it down by 24% over the full 6 months. And nobody wanted to talk to us.
Talk about how you measured what you did.
Well, I used their measurements. We didn't measure it.
Who was the there?
There is the South Coast
Air Quality Management
District, STOMD.
Okay. And so what happens? They have a particular record, a way of recording how much smog
right.
is in the air.
Exactly.
That's available to the public?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
Okay.
Yeah, they get $101 million a year. They should be able to provide you with statistics. They publish the statistics in the newspaper.
Okay.
Every day.
So what happens? You set up what kind of an instrument to do this?
We set up 14 stations in Southern California.
Are they like, is it technology? Is it, what is it? Is it a tube?
No, it's like the vortex generators, pairs of cones that are mounted together on arms and they rotate. And that's what clears the smog.
How long do they have to be there to clear the smog?
They run continuously throughout the whole season.
Is that something that could be put in place, for example, in, let's say, San Bernardino or Los Angeles or
sure.
Greece?
Sure, it could be put in place anywhere.
And it will go to work on?
It'll clear the air. It'll clear the air because it will generate the devices that we design and build. They will cause the development of an implosive vortex.
Talk about what implosion is,
An implosive vortex, a vortex that goes inward.
Okay.
And an implosive vortex will entrain atmospheric pollution and drive it right to the ground, and it takes the pollution out of the air that way. So it doesn't matter how much pollution you put up in the air, if you have enough of those vortex generators, and they cost, perhaps $100 each to make.
That's it?
Yeah.
So we could have these vortex generators?
You have all you want.
All over the country and all over the world?
Right.
Eliminating smog and cleaning the air?
Right. But that's not what the political people want.
But it doesn't really matter what the political people want. It matters what the humanity needs.
Yeah, well, then they'll come around and make sure that you don't get to do this. Because you're attacking a very large body of business.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you are tuning into It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. I'm here with Trevor James Constable, who is a weather engineer who has been making it rain literally for over 30 years. He also has the ability to eliminate smog and to set up devices around the world that eliminate smog and clear the air. There is also the opportunity to prevent hurricanes and to deactivate them prior to them manifesting. And this is available for most of us that are listening. We're quite aware that the United States of America and other places around the world have been going through geographical heartache and havoc with earthquakes and hurricanes and tsunamis and all types of earth changes. Mr. Constable, what do you say to the people that are genuinely concerned that associate rain and the weather with God? In other words, in many contracts, sometimes, let's say with an insurance company, it'll say, we can't be responsible for, quote, acts of God, like the weather.
Yeah.
And so a lot of us intuitively associate weather with, like, an act of God, like the way it is, you know, the universal desire. And some people even say, well, if an entire society was cleaned out by a hurricane or the earthquake that just happened in Pakistan, well, that's God's way of saying that that needed to happen, and it's good for population control and all kinds of things, and it's survival of the fittest. There's all kinds of ramifications of what people say to themselves about why even some terrible things are good for the greater good. How would you speak to the people that say they have a concern, they're open to you and what your contribution is, but they're very concerned that they don't want a man or a group to play God?
Uh-huh.
And that something having to do with engineering weather puts one in a position, in effect, of playing God. You can understand that, can't
sure
you?
Sure, I can.
That concern.
Sure, I've been accused of playing God more times than I have fingers and toes.
But what would you say to them to put them at ease that intervening with weather, you're really, on a certain level, a facilitator, correct?
Yes.
Kind of like a midwife.
Right.
Acting as a midwife to weather.
That's exactly right.
That's how I see it. But other people would see it like you're, quote, controlling the weather. What is true?
Well, neither of those things, really.
Okay.
Neither of those things. Basically, it comes to you into possession of certain knowledge that permits certain things to be done that are not otherwise done. They're not done conventionally. They are beyond the capacity of conventional meteorology to do these things. But if by pursuing new knowledge I find out something about how to do something that is beyond the conventional people, then I should be able to do it, I feel, especially if I make available to them the means by which I do it, which is an empty tube. There's no big secret to weather engineering at all. It's possible to do it. So it's no different, really, to doing anything else in the world that's possible to you technically.
Could you see how some people would be afraid, though? Just on a, let's say they totally understood the frame of reference. They understand that your work is intended from pure heart. Mm-hmm. But a concern that if that knowledge became more readily available, that there could be manipulators of the weather.
Oh, I'm sure they're concerned about that. But I would be, too. I'd be just as concerned as they are about manipulators getting into it. And that's true of everything. You know, why do we have guns?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
The same principle.
Why do you think there are droughts that continue in certain parts of the world?
Well, because droughts tend to be self-reinforcing.
Talk about
that. That's the nature of the beast. That when the moisture disappears in a given area or you don't have rainfall, what happens is that the ground dries out and the atmosphere, the ether, cycles in a completely different way to what it does when rainfall is normal. So that drought becomes self-reinforcing. The etheric potential of a droughted area goes down. And that means that the energy flows out of that area into surrounding areas. That's how a drought works. That's why all droughts tend to be self-reinforcing. You follow that?
Yes. I do. So let's take the Sudan in Africa. Does a drought have to do with, or this phenomenon have to do, if there's a nearby body of water?
Well,
like
it does.
Like a lake it or does. Ocean or
yeah,
anything.
It does, definitely, because look at North Africa, is a gigantic desert. There is no rivers or anything there in the greater part of North Africa, so it's droughted automatically by that, although there have been engineers who have gone in there and have created great artificial lakes with Reich-type devices.
Seriously?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Huge lakes in northeastern Africa.
You know people that have done
this? Yes, I do.
Are they still living in
Yes,
with us?
Sure.
And what the purpose of putting in lakes was to make it more habitable?
Right. Yeah, well, they just wanted water. So, you know, they gave them water and they had these huge lakes. The lakes were miles long. They were not anything pedifogging at all. Yeah, that was a gentleman up in Oregon did that several years ago now.
The lakes are still there?
As far as I know, they are.
Did he have to get permission to put those lakes
in?
Oh,
yes, you work with the government.
Right.
Yes, you have to work with the government with weather engineering.
Is there a way through this technology and through your experience to calibrate, I don't know if I'm using the right word, but to calibrate the ability for a location, let's say the Sudan, which is in a droughted state most of the time, to have rainfall?
Yes, I'm sure you could. I'm sure you could do that. But it would be an ambitious project in the sense that you'd involve several countries in it. And you would have to bring the water up from the south into the Sudan. That's what the way it would be done.
I see. You'd have to go to a different location.
Right. Yeah.
By the way, that was fascinating in reading your book, Loom of the Future. Mm-hmm. One of the few books that I've read of yours, of the first three. I've also read The Cosmic Pulse of Life, and They Live in the Sky, and saw your two videos. But you could actually be in one country. And by the way you point the tube, have it rain in another location? Talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is that etheric weather engineering is not something that is done at a given point. It's done remotely from a point. For example, if we set up an apparatus here, we would make it rain, say, between here and Seattle rather than here.
How would we know that once you initiated it here and you set it up from here, the apparatus is here, how do you track where the causation comes from?
Well, you understand, first of all, that the flows that you are interdicting go from north to south in the northern hemisphere in the wintertime. And by blocking them, you cause them to build up. You prevent their flowing, you know, temporarily. I'm just speaking on a temporary basis, and they will drop where they build up. There will be a drop of moisture where they build up. That's how it's done.
You said in your book on the loom of the future, there are unmistakable signatures to rain, and to, just before the rain forms.
Right.
You talked about towing, brewing, and accretion.
Yeah.
Could you talk about those, please?
Well, towing is something you do when you're working on the road, when you're working in a car with a car-mounted device. This is all basically obsolete now. It's no longer done this way, but basically this is how it's done. You have a device on the roof of the car, and you proceed, we'll say, from west to east. We're speaking now of Los Angeles.
Yes, let's take Los Angeles.
Where it's actually happened.
Okay.
And you start off and you get out on the number 10 freeway going to the desert.
I'm getting very excited about going on the number 10 again.
It'll
never be the same to me. I used to get worried when I carried my tennis rackets in the car. Now if I see a tube, I'm going to get very nervous.
That's right.
Something's coming.
You should. But you point the tubes astern of the car, point them, you know, in the direction that you have come from, that is the west. And if you do it all in the right way, you'll see that there is an accumulation builds up behind you. And this moves with you as you move out to the desert, and it will pile right into the Banning Pass area when you get to there. That's the way it works.
In your book, on page 69, you talked about one of the things that you learned in this particular process of watching how this works is that you could actually bring in fog.
Yeah.
Talk about that, too.
Well, that goes back a long way. It goes back into the 80s, actually. I don't do that anymore. But
we found out that
if you went on Imperial Highway and you start off at the Harbor Freeway and you go directly due west on the Imperial Highway all the way as far as you can, by the time you get down to the waterfront, provided it is not a situation where you have a drought in vogue, but if it's a normal day, you will have immense fog come in over LAX. You practically close the airport. So you have to be very careful about doing that.
That's pretty heavy, dude.
Yeah, right.
So there's a whole navigation
protocol. Oh yeah.
To all of this.
Yeah, right. The people who are in charge of these things are not familiar with vital force. This is something that doesn't exist for them.
Right.
You see, so if you offer them a device that uses vital force to clarify the air, you know, they don't want to look at it because of the problems with their own constitution, that they're not familiar with it and they don't like it.
Correct. I could totally understand that, except that you and I both know that many people will go to a doctor. I don't understand what the doctor knows. I don't know what he or she knows. And I don't understand if they're doing a surgical procedure, what they're doing. Do I as a patient need to know? Frankly, I need to know the essence of it, but I don't need to understand what they do because they're the practitioners. They need to know.
Yeah.
That's why I'm going to them.
That's the problem is
so,
that they don't know.
but in this particular case, you know, I don't think that the concern has to do with the greater good.
Uh-huh.
And the greater good is starting to get concerned, if they have not already been concerned. And our listeners are probably concerned with what is happening on the earth in terms of climate.
Yeah.
And there are many people that are saying that the way things are going, that even England may be frozen over literally in an ice age within 20 years. Climate change is a big concern to a lot of people.
Well, they'll have to learn about vital force and they won't have to be worried about it.
You don't think that there is some type of association with the climate? There's some innate association with climate being, quote, from God that immediately says, well, that's the fate of the earth.
God will let you use the vital force all you want. And that's really the key to it right there, is that they will not advance to understanding the existence of the vital force. They will not have it.
Well, let's say that they won't have it, but there are people who will have it. There are people who have been cleaned out by the hurricanes, who have been cleaned out by either volcanoes or earthquakes. There are millions of people that are in drought and don't have access to fresh drinking water. I had the opportunity a year ago to interview Bill Cox, who I know you know
He's
very well.
He's a great man.
He is a great man. And the earth and the world needs him very badly,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, they do. But it's not working. You see what I mean?
I do see. And, you know, you are both at a later chapter in life. And my concern is that we are very much dependent on rainfall for drinking water. Mm-hmm. And in cases where a society or a culture or a country is not ready, willing, and able to employ and deploy your services, that may be a country that is ready for the services of Bill Cox, who has the ability to access primary water that mm-hmm. doesn't come from rainfall.
Right.
It's like if you access anything that has to do with our sustainability in a different way than what's already been organized and touted, it's dismissed.
That's right. They won't have it.
And the bottom line is that water now is being privatized and has been being privatized for the last five years.
That's right. It's the latest high-level racket is to privatize the world's water.
And so I think that this is very, very critical. I was wondering if you could also speak about something you wrote about called the horizontal dark bar. Now, I know we're getting a little technical mm-hmm. with the weather engineering part, but there is a way that you know when the rain that you have just produced is your rain,
yes,
so to speak. Could you talk about what the horizontal dark bar is and describe it for yeah. the listening audience, please?
The horizontal dark bar is an accretion of moisture. The reason that it appears dark is that it is moisture, and it is in a in a much drier atmosphere, therefore it appears that way.
You said that there's a clear blackish line
yeah.
along the bottom of the clouds that brews up and bases itself on the horizontal dark bar.
That's right.
Bar.
That's right. Well, the moisture accretes where the dark bar is, and it spreads upwards through the clouds. That's how it goes.
What does accrete mean for those of us who
accrete
don't know?
Accrete means, you know, accumulate.
Okay, accumulate.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it turns black?
Well, not jet black, but close to it.
Okay.
Much darker than its surroundings.
Darker than its surroundings.
Yes, that's right.
And heavy cloud comes out of nowhere?
Yeah, right. That's a common thing.
Comes in over the scene.
Yeah.
And temperatures are known to drop?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's happens commonly in gun car work where you're driving in cars.
You said also on page 52 of Loom of the Future that fog will not form if the ether is expanding.
That's right.
It's a phenomenon of contraction and stasis in the ether. That would seem to be very key and critical to airports.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Isn't there a place in your body of work right now and has been for the airports to be able to utilize you with regard to the fog that often accompanies a lot of locations where people are flying in and out of?
Well, as a matter of fact, a very famous man once sponsored this, General Curtis LeMay, right after the 1990 smog program in Los Angeles, and he became convinced that these devices worked. And he was going to set up devices of mine at the most heavily fogged base in Air Force Base in the U.S., and unfortunately, he died at that time. So it was ready to go then. It would have taken a personality like that to get interest in it.
Well, I think that there would be, at this point, a lot of interest in it. You know, I am of the believer that there's so much practical, very practical applications to your work in the world, even more now at this time in human history than possibly that has come before this time, because there are more people flying, even since 9/11. There are more people that are using airplanes and flying, and the weather is more unstable than we've ever known it to be
mm-hmm.
in many, many places. Can you clear fog as well?
Oh, yes, sure.
You can clear smog. We talked
about
that. Yeah,
we clear fog. We used to clear fog on the ship. We used to do that.
Talk about that.
The Commodore would ask me to intervene when we had fog. And I would, this was when I had equipment aboard the ship that was suitable to do that.
What kind of a ship was that?
This was the Maui. This was the Matson container ship, the Maui.
What were you doing on that ship?
I was a radio officer.
And what does a radio officer do on that ship? Probably not, doing a radio show.
Not much.
Somebody was letting you prepare your weather engineering.
That's right. Exactly.
And who let you do that?
Who
empowered you to do that?
Oh, the Commodore authorized it.
That's remarkable.
He didn't participate, actually, in it, but he made it known that anybody that interfered with the equipment would have to answer to him.
Or be sent off the ship.
That's right. They pack their stuff.
Jump ship.
That's right. Because there were people who were upset by the existence of this equipment on board, who would have thrown it overboard if they had had the chance. That's part of the public attitude towards it, is that the individuals who are not able to tolerate it want to destroy it. And that's one thing you have to be careful of.
It seems like when you say fog will not form if the ether is expanding.
That's right.
That means that you know how to diagnose the ether, not only to recognize it and to interact with it, but to diagnose it.
Well, to some degree.
Let me put it
that way. In other words, I can tell when it's expanded.
Could this be taught?
I'm sure it could. But you'd need to have a background in Reich's work, for example, to really understand what you were doing. Otherwise, it would just be a question of how much humidity there was and the standard parameters of atmosphere that are used, and they really don't have anything to do, nothing very greatly to do, with the etheric stasis of the atmosphere.
Is it something you think you're born with as well?
No,
I think you're... Like a sensitive instrument that maybe you're more receptive to this?
No, I don't think so. I think, anybody can be taught these things. Most of the time they are aware of these things, but it's not connecting to the conscious mind. Let me put it that way. There are individuals that we had on the ship at different times. I mean, you've got to remember, I was on that ship for 14 years. That we had individuals who came aboard the ship who were endowed with a natural ability to use this equipment. You didn't have to train them at all, hardly, and they would be able to do it. Once they got the general idea of how it all worked, then they could do it, and they used to do it when I wasn't on the ship, when I was on vacation.
Watch out for your apprentices,
yes,
right?
That's right.
You spoke a lot about something. There was a sentence in your book that says, free primary power via the ether.
Yeah.
What is free primary power via the ether?
Well, power without having to burn anything. That's basically it. I mean, we can't get anywhere in this civilization unless we burn something. It all goes back to burning. And what allows us to propel ourselves around without burning anything?
That's a great question.
See? And they don't look at this. It's not looked at, not studied.
Well, there's got to be some people who are asking these questions, probably behind the scenes asking questions, having discussions about it. You're talking about financed work in it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
When you say that's not being done, you mean financed work in it.
Right. Right, and nobody's looking to see if they can get into this continuum and pull out power from it. And it has, it has been done. Tesla did it. That's why nobody has been able to replicate Tesla's work, because they don't understand that he got into the ether, that he wrote about it. He called it the luminiferous ether.
It's been said and documented that Tesla had many, many, many patents.
Yeah.
And that some of his patents were so formidable that they are in possession of our government, and only our government has them under lock and seal. They were so formidable.
It's right there in that book of Colonel Corso's dealing with the UFOs that, they went to his lab and stole it all when he died. That's known, that a lot of his stuff is missing. But they're not really up to doing what he did. They're not up to it yet. It's a little bit beyond them.
Some say that the weather engineering, that he actually has patents or had patents for the capability to initiate and sustain weather engineering practices, but that most of the public is not aware of that.
That's right. That's right. The public wouldn't be able to understand it at all. They wouldn't be able to understand any of Tesla's work. It's not for the public at all to understand. It's for technical people, and technical people are strapped down in the world that has no vital force. The world doesn't have any vitality.
Let's suppose that you were given the green light by sufficient powers that be, let's say in the United States, to proceed in full gear with the smog elimination setup, the fog diagnosis at airports, that was put into motion so that planes could take off and land uninterrupted, at least by fog. And you were given the green light to go ahead and to initiate rainfall in areas where people are suffering tremendously from drought. What would be, where would you go? What would you do? What would you put into motion? Let's go there right now. I'm going to fly. Let's fly into that articulate vision.
Well, the first thing I would do would be get out of the United States.
Okay.
That's what I would do because you just can't function here.
Well, let's just say you were just given permit. You were given the green light now.
But I'd go down to Mexico, to La Paz, down in Baja California Sur, and I'd set up a one-year program to change their climate down there because no orthodox system or approach can deal with that, and I can.
Well, talk about you. What would you change? What are they suffering?
Well, they don't have any water there. This is the problem. Bill Cox will tell you that they have plenty of water underneath. You know that
primary
adequate
water.
Like that. The primary water, they're loaded with it, but they don't have any. And the
rainwater.
The rainwater that they have is being polluted by the ocean getting in there, and so they have to go very deeply if they're going to use the primary water. What I would do is simply produce rain in Baja California Sur and do it on a steady basis so that they had year-round rain, and I would have the government plant trees all over Baja California so that they would have antennas to keep the rain coming.
What do you mean by that?
Well, every tree is an antenna for rain. You must know that, surely.
I didn't know that.
Well,
here I am. I have a company, the Rainmaking Company, and a show. It's Rainmaking Time, and I'm a treeless wonder. And my last name is Greenhouse. How could I be so devoid of this primary knowledge?
Yeah, right. Well, there you are.
N capital K.
Yeah.
Trees are antennas for rain.
Right. So
because of oxygen?
Well, because of the total metabolism of the tree contributes to rain coming in. And one of the problems you have all over the world is that they're smashing down trees and putting asphalt down, and the next thing you know, they have a drought. That happened in Malaysia.
Okay, so Baja California, you would go in, you would plant trees like crazy.
Right.
And you would set up sustainable rainfall.
Right.
See, ongoing, consistent rainfall.
They have a situation there that's quite unique, inasmuch as they have vessels, ships, that run across to Mazatlan from La Paz. And those ships could be equipped with devices of mine so that every trip they made every day, they would be engineering rain automatically. They wouldn't have to do anything, just mount this tube on there. They could do that. That would be easy to do. So this would alter the rainfall totals of Sur Baja completely. And next thing you know, you'd have all kinds of foliage growing up there because it's in the same latitude as Oahu in Hawaii. And it could be, completely revolutionized. The entire state of Sur Baja could be put on a new basis this way. And that would be within my capabilities to do that.
How long would that take in terms of a project commitment?
You'd need a contract for at least a year to do that.
1 year. Would you need to be there? You need to physically be there?
Oh, yeah, I would be there. But, I could leave associates down there to handle it when I wasn't there.
Where would you go next?
Well,
we're in the visioning part right now.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're tuning into It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. I'm honored to be in the cockpit of some type of a imaginary opportunity here with Trevor James Constable, who is a weather engineer who has proven that he has not only the ability to make rain, to engineer rain, but that this knowledge is accessible and real. And the tools that are used to deliver the rain are accessible and inexpensive. He also is involved in smog elimination, in fog eradication. This could be utilized at airports throughout the world who have difficulties taking off and landing. And I'm just delighted to be here with you today.
Mm-hmm.
I had heard about you 8 years ago when I represented a scientist in my company that was bringing a solution to kidney dialysis patients
mm-hmm.
who introduced me to the Singapore gentleman who's been...
Oh, yeah, George Wu.
Your backer for many years.
War.
And that's how I had heard about you. So what would be the next place
You should just take one thing at a time, even in terms of just revolutionizing the climate in Sur Baja. That is more than most people can tolerate right there.
Let us suppose that, God forbid, the politics of going there and getting there and getting it done were adverse to this.
Well, you wouldn't go there unless you could get a clean shot at it.
Correct.
There would be no point in that.
But let's talk about...
Just like there's no point in doing it anywhere in the U.S. for that reason.
So let's talk about another offshore location. Let us talk outside the United States of America, another place or two that you would recommend is suffering in some way.
Well, I think Malaysia is a very good place to work. Very good place to work. Because you could keep them free of drought. Very, very readily using their own Air Force planes and with just minimal investment.
I would think that in Malaysia, that would be the least thing that they would suffer from would be drought.
Oh, no, they have severe droughts there because of the terrain that they have laid bare with the smashing down of the trees and everything like that. They've laid bare thousands of acres that they didn't even think about before because they were covered with rubber trees. That's one thing that's happened there. And it's surprising, really, that you do get astonishingly intense droughts in tropical climates.
See, I would have never thought that, and I don't think anybody listening would have associated drought with an intense climate.
That's right. That's right. That's another place that we could work. See, we've already worked in China, and that's not too good a situation, I don't think.
You don't think the receptivity is sufficient?
No. Although they know all about the chi there. It's just that now you have a mechanistic overlay has come into Chinese science and things like that, and they have lost their way to that extent.
This is a hard question, but what happens when Trevor James Constable passes away?
Oh, nothing. They'll bury me.
What happens?
No, nothing.
What happens to weather engineering? What happens to smog eradication? What happens to fog elimination?
It'll go back into the unknown and stay there for a while and come back out again when some valiant individual brings it out. It'll be reborn. It can't be stopped. Some people, want to stop it. They delight to stopping it, and that is a fact. But they will not succeed because it's part of the human future.
Would you be interested if somebody were able to arrange a way inside the United States for an area that was heavily smogged, really heavily smogged bad, if that area and the powers that be in that area were to become open or receptive to truly eradicating the smog?
No, it isn't going to happen.
You don't think so?
No, it isn't going to happen because smog is an industry. Smog is a business.
How so?
And
for those of us who are listening?
Well, that's just like they got, frightened of what we were doing when we were working here before. We had three very spectacular years here dealing with smog. And the smog people didn't even want to know us. They didn't want anything to do with it. And especially when we brought it down by 24% in 1 year.
Do you think it could be brought down more with
more
work?
Oh, yeah, no question about it. Just a question of we did that with, I think, George Wu put up $35,000 for that.
And that's when you put the different instruments?
That put...
14 instruments?
Yeah, 14 stations.
14 stations.
Yeah.
And do they have to be manned on an hourly basis?
No.
Or you just put them there
they
and let them
do
their
thing?
They just
need to be, secure. That's, it could be on roofs and that sort of thing. And where nobody could see them, that could be done.
If those particular devices don't hurt anybody,
uh-huh,
and they don't hurt anything, why can't that be sold to the lay public? Why couldn't I put one on my house?
Well, you can if you want to. Sure you can. Sure you can put it on your house.
Just in the way you would get like a garbage disposal or
mm-hmm,
something like
sure
that. I mean, a lot of people don't take whole garbage and just throw it out in the street.
No.
We have a process.
Unless
for
they're in Mexico.
You know, there's a process for that.
Uh-huh.
So Why couldn't there be a process for at the individual level for an individual to take personal responsibility for what they can do, and they put a station on their house or wherever, and the individual takes this in their hands and not...
Well, it would probably be just fine until they found out exactly what you were doing, especially if you were successful, you'd attract their attention. And then there'd be all kinds of regulations would be adduced that would tell you that you couldn't do that.
What could these things cost? Let's say if I wanted to buy one and put one on.
$100.
$100?
Yeah, 150 max.
And this could really help eliminate smog. Now, what if this were introduced in mass? Would it be too much?
No.
So you couldn't hurt anything?
No, no, nothing. Couldn't hurt anybody.
So if there were a million of them?
There's no power to them other than the power to turn the motor. There isn't any chemicals. There's nothing.
Right.
See, it's a geometric thing.
But if it clears smog, right?
Yeah.
And it's put in place in mass, that's what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about a scenario, a potential scenario. You know, what would it take if 14 could clear smog by 24%?
Mm-hmm.
What would it take in L.A.? Like 50 or 100?
Well, if you put in 50, I'm sure you'd clear it completely.
50 a city?
Yeah.
Would that sound about right?
Right. Well, maybe less because we know more now than we did in 1990.
Okay. And if somebody were interested in helping bring this through, and there were receptive people, in California or outside of California, would you be willing to talk with them or meet with them?
Well, it all depends on, you know, people think that they're influential. They have that idea. You know, you're speaking now of people who are influential. And they only last so long, in my experience, when they come up against the establishment, let's put it that way. They only last so long, they don't.
What, they last until the first physical
threat? You have someone like Curtis LeMay, that would be different. I would say yes, but, you know, he's gone now.
But if we were to locate, or somebody listening to the show could locate a person of that stature who was ready, willing, and able, and receptive, ready to go, are you?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
Sure.
Great.
Sure. Provided they don't send for me down at Sur Baja.
And just on a complete vision level, is there a particular place in the world, aside from Baja, California, or Baja, Mexico, where you would like to bring down a spectacular rainfall for the pure pleasure and literally the spectacular nature of it to do it? There's
no
particular place.
No, I don't do things on that basis.
A place in need.
Yeah.
A particular place in need outside of Mexico. Is there any other place in the world?
No, not that I know of. Not that I would care to do that.
You said Mexico and Malaysia.
Yeah.
Is there a third place?
No, not really.
Those
are the two best places that I know. And, of course, Hawaii, but Hawaii is so small that, you know, it's not of any consequence.
What about Africa? Because I'm sure many of the listeners are thinking about Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Africa's known as being the desert and a drought location. If there was a very big call.
It would have to be a government that did it.
Okay.
You know, the rulers of Africa are tough and they're smart. And you're not going to be able to get away with anything with them.
You're saying the politics is too thick.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Okay.
Politics is too thick. It is everywhere, really, because the people that have the juice right now are those who are trying to privatize the world's water resources.
Correct.
That's what they're out to do. And they want to charge everybody, you know, all that the traffic will bear. Just to drink water.
Water may become, if we don't take hold of our power at the level of the individual, the oil, the next oil consumption.
Yeah, right.
And scramble.
Yeah, it'll be more important than oil before very long, especially if they find out how to turn it into oxygen and hydrogen.
Sounds like you know a little something about that.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been tuning into a segment of It's Rainmaking Time with Trevor James Constable, a weather engineer, an international historian who has had over 40 years experience eliminating smog, fog, and has the ability to engineer rain. For those of you who are interested in moving this work further during the last chapter of Mr. Constable's life, I'd like you to call Kim Greenhouse at the station at 818-980-0966, and I will be happy to do the screening on behalf of Mr. Constable to make sure that the people that are interested in helping bring this work to the next level are made available to him. I want to thank you for listening. And remember, it's rainmaking time. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor. Mm-hmm.